Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting adventure in truth. We're excited to bring our podcast to you again. Week 28, I think we're hitting. 28. Well, it's a little off because 26 was you and I, and something happened 18 minutes in, and we no longer have that. I have got the 18 minutes, but that's just about the time we get warmed up. So 27 or 28, depending on how you look at it. And we're excited to be here. I'm here. I'm Jim Case, and I'm here today with my awesome friend and compadre there, Dr. Jeffrey Smith.
Hello, everybody.
And today, Dr. Jeff brought a kind of an interesting and obscure, maybe a good word, topic to bring to the table today, more about what it represents than probably what it is. But the thing is called the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. And a little bit of history of them, they're very old, like BC old, like 32,000 years BC old. But there's a lot of, just from a brief perusal that I did, a lot of information about how Thoth, this being, used these tablets and the information that's contained on them, and in conjunction with the pyramids and in conjunction with Atlantis. And so there's a lot of tie-ins to a lot of how things evolved for us as humans, and also I forgot what I was going to say. How about that? So Jeff is bringing the topic to the table, so we'll let him get started. And tell us a little bit more about, while these things sound like they're kind of way far out there, they actually exist and they have been being researched for decades, because they really lay a foundation for pretty much all of the truths and belief systems that we've built about what it is to be human, which is a very big statement. But I'll let Jeff dive in here and let's have some fun.
Right on, man. So, hey, gang, I'm sitting outside in my girlfriend's patio. There's the sound of the pool in the background. We're on the north side of Camp Pendleton. They're shooting artillery this afternoon, so you might hear a few booms go off in the background. And she's got a couple of dogs here that might bark. So just, you know, be advised, all those sounds may want to jump in and play as well. 30 minutes before we hit record, Jim and I were chatting about what we would talk about. I planted a little bit of a seed last week from some research that I've been doing on these emerald tablets, and just kind of put it out there that I wanted to tread lightly down this rabbit trail. And Jim being this is one of the things that I love about Jim Case, and I hope that as you guys continue to listen in on this podcast, you know, Jim's a smart guy, and at the same time, he's open. And if there's anything that I really, really appreciate about another human being, is that they can suspend their intelligence and open up their curiosity to just receive new information before they make an opinion or a judgment on it, and just kind of sit with it for a while and see how it feels and just kind of like go with it. And that's, Jim never even heard about these things 8 days ago. These didn't exist in Jim's mind. Today, I got him to do a little introduction on something that he didn't even know about 8 days ago, but he's open. And like he said, our point isn't to prove or disprove anything about these things. It's just really fascinating information to me, mm-hmm. of which Jim's willing to play along with and kind of see where this goes. But I know Jim well enough, and you guys, if you haven't already, you know, 28 sessions times 2 hours, you know, what is, I don't know what that adds up to, over 50 hours of getting to know Jim from, he's open and he's non-judgmental and he's willing to process, he's willing to dialogue, he's willing to argue, but that's just one of the things that I really love and enjoy.
And ultimately willing to run my mouth.
Yeah, and kind of have fun with it. And, you know, there's been, you know, some of these sessions we've done have been a little bit rough and tumble where we're really pushing on new paradigms or we're challenging old belief systems or things that, you know, we're maybe really attached to or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's been a fun adventure. And I know this is going to turn out the same way. So, about, I don't know, a month ago, and I can't even remember how, because these things just come. You guys, you know how it works. You're driving the car, and all of a sudden there's a commercial that comes on, or you get an email, or somehow the universe is going, hello, I want to bring your attention to this, and you devote two brain cells to it, or enough to buy the book, or read the email, or watch the video, or whatever it is, listen to the podcast. And then, you know, God starts talking to you or the great white buffalo or however it works for you. You start getting a download of just maybe a slightly different way of looking at something. And it ever so slowly, gracefully, lovingly allows you to open up to some wisdom, some information, some truth. And I really have a hard time defining what truth is, even though that's in the title of our podcast. And I think that's somewhat ironic. But as people are open, and that's all we're asking for, is a little bit of openness here. If you're not open, you're going to end up being judgmental, and you'll have a lot of fun, and maybe even some of these podcasts we're doing, Jim, could be played at parties where people are just laughing their asses off at how freaking ridiculous these two smart guys are talking about stuff that just makes no sense to anybody at all, but it's entertaining. And if that's the purpose of these podcasts, well, that's fine. But I got to believe there's probably one or two or maybe three other people on the planet that might hear them and go, oh, how interesting. I can add that to what I already know.
I want to throw something in the mix, and this is not meant to derail. It's meant to clarify, in a way, something that you talked about with regard to exploring these kind of new ideas and how these things show up and that they show up. And I'm amazed as I observe my path and the path of people that I've watched going through this process of becoming more conscious or transformation or whatever you want to call it. But that evolutionary expansion that goes on with all of us. But the thing that I find fascinating is that I often wonder, as you progress in this spiral, as you get into the tighter rounds of this spiral, as we're evolving and growing and becoming more conscious, I almost think that we actually are able to access more of universal mind, because the things that show up to inspire us and the things that like, even with the Emerald Tablets, it isn't so much the tablets that's of necessary consequence. It's what they're saying about life as a human being on the planet. And they connect dots in ways, and even though I don't know a lot about it, the little bit you've talked about, there is this thing of connecting dots, which we talk about a lot. And it seems that I've observed on my path, And I've observed it with you, whether you call it that or not, where these things show up that take us into a deeper understanding of the human experience in a way that's very fulfilling and very satisfying. It's not woo-woo in the sense that we're looking for ways off the planet. We're not looking for how do we not be human anymore. We're looking for how do we immerse ourselves even more completely in this experience to be able to be the best we can be within it. And some of this information is just startlingly amazing in a way, because it's why would someone create that information? Why would someone bring that information to the table if it wasn't useful in some form for some reason?
Right, right. Yeah.
Anyway, so I just wanted to interject there.
So let's go back a couple, maybe a month ago, of I don't recall how, but I got inspired to read a book called Thoth the Atlantean and the 12 Emerald Tablets. And it's a thing. You can get it on Amazon or Audible. If right now, while you're listening to this, you want to Google this and then hit images, you can see that these tablets are a real thing. Jim, if you'd like to do that just to entertain me and then put it up there so that people could see that this is really an artifact that does in fact exist. It's not just a fictional thing in my mind. Yeah. Yep.
So can you see it?
Yes, I can. They're beautiful, actually. So it's a real thing, and obviously people have spent perhaps their life's work and energy translating them into languages that we speak today from the languages that they were originally written.
Book covers look familiar?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's what you were talking about, the Emerald Tablets of Thoth.
Yep. So this entity, this being, this spirit, this person on the planet 38,000 years ago from a city that we now believe is under the sea, this city called Atlantis, and people may wonder, well, how is it under the sea now? And I swear all these things used to just be so sci-fi or comic book-ish to me, but again, just the slightest little bit of openness will all of a sudden just go, oh, well, that really wouldn't be so hard. For example, tectonic plates move, and they move not only laterally, but they move vertically, mm-hmm. and sometimes quite dramatically in a very, very short amount of time. And Jim referenced earlier the Andes Mountains are still growing and gaining in elevation. But what I'm talking about would be rapid shifts that would happen in thousands of feet of elevation in as little as days at a time, where there's just cataclysmic events changing. The magma in the center of the Earth, like ocean currents, there's also magma in the center of the Earth currents that are happening, and they affect magnetism on the surface of the Earth. And without getting or pretending like I'm a geologist, which I'm not, I've only scratched the surface of any of that stuff, but I believe it's safe to say that the surface of the Earth has changed many times and will continue to change many times. There's even so much information right now that there are at least 100 civilizations in the Mediterranean Sea that are less than 35 feet or less than 35 feet under the surface of the ocean. 35 feet isn't much, but to know that there are at least 100 civilizations that are underwater 35 feet or less that answer all these questions of all these ancient writings, and Atlantis is one of those cities. So I'm not trying to prove that Atlantis exists. I'm simply saying that there are plausible, logical explanations that could explain how these things have happened, but they just aren't here today. You can't go drive to Atlantis or catch a flight to Atlantis today without taking a submarine to get there. Some of the 35 feet civilizations underwater can be explained by the Ice Age. And at some point, probably not in our lifetime, but it certainly may occur where the sea level is going to rise quite a bit higher as a result of climate change. But, you know, climate change can go in both directions. And at a point where the planet was colder, the sea level was lower. It just kind of, it's common sense stuff. So it isn't really that hard to grasp. So sorry for the belaboring that whole point about trying to give some credence or legitimacy to the city of Atlantis. Let's just for the sake of me talking about it more, assume that it is a thing, was a thing, and that there was a being on the planet that wrote these tablets and left them behind as an artifact for us to glean from and to understand a little bit more about where we came from, why we're here, and where we're going. I hope that sounds familiar to some people that are listening, because we spent a lot of time on that
in like
four or five episodes. This being Thoth is a godlike figure, not God, and references God. And in reading the book that I referenced earlier, it's so fascinating to me that in listening to, because it was written in the first person as though Thoth was writing the book, like almost like an autobiography. And it was translated in the King James. And as I was listening to it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm listening to the Bible, but from 38,000 years ago. I mean, wow. Like, yeah, it's just, it's mind-blowing that the credit has been given to this book we call the Holy Bible that actually is almost, if you want to accuse somebody of plagiarism, I'm going to go there. I'm going to say that this holy book that we think is only at the most, in some cases, 6,000 years old, I'm going to say, well, you can actually take parts of it and put it to 38,000 years old, and it's just a carbon copy. It's just an absolute chiseled out, hammered out, word by word, carbon copy of something that was on the planet 38,000 years ago, word for word. And I'm talking about some of the Proverbs, some of the things that were that Job had written, that King David had written or given the credit having written, or Moses. Mm-hmm. And that's not really here for me to debate, because I don't really care when those things were written, because to live in a way where you've got a nice balance between taking care and loving self and also loving others, that's really, to me, the code that we're trying to live by, is being aware of what I do and how that affects others. It doesn't matter to me when that was written or how that's been translated. That's still probably a good way to live. So the point of our podcast today isn't really just debunk the Bible or say where its origins were. I just find it fascinating that with the slightest little bit of openness, you can at least trace that back well beyond the dates that were given and the generations that are listed in the Bible, and the stories that were told appear to have been told many, many, many times before. And it isn't perhaps as simple or as put together in the way that we're reading the book right now. Does it really change anything? I don't know. That part I don't know. And we can have some fun and we can debate that. I'm just simply laying out that I discovered something for me that helps me realize that this information, this intelligence, this way to live goes a lot farther back than just 6,000 years ago. It still doesn't account for fossil records. It still doesn't account for the dinosaurs and all of those other things. We all know that the planet wasn't just created 6,000 years ago, as the Holy Book would suggest that it was. And again, that's not the point of this discussion. The point of the discussion is there's an amazing, loving, wise energy that's been here for a long, long time. And civilizations have risen and fallen and been enlightened and have been eradicated. And it just seems like it starts over and it starts over again.
Yeah. I think this, if anything, it helps to establish even more continuity to the experience. I mean, you know, when we started this, it's the same thing. Who are we? Where we come from? Why are we here? I mean, those age-old questions, I think as we evolve and become more conscious, as each individual becomes more curious about how how am I here? Why am I, you know, the miracle of how I became here and that how I became and how I'm an adult and the process of how I got to where I am, how you got to where you are, how we've all gotten here, that I'm continually fascinated by, especially of late, this kind of idea where we're not a lot different than we were many thousands of years ago, in the sense that the core of the things that you, that scientists have talked about and the ways that they talk about other races and other groups of people that have been on the planet, we're a little more technically advanced than, or at least we think we are a little more technically advanced than some of our predecessors. But some of the core principles, the things that we're experiencing right now on the planet, you know, the differences of belief systems that are so diametrically opposed, and how the, you can't even use language to bridge the gap because there's no hearing going on, you know, and there's this constant flow of things like, you know, you think about things like Game of Thrones, you know, that's so wildly popular and so people are so into it. And yet there's not a lot of difference now. We just have different clothes. We've added things to what we do. So, you know, where there they may have only showered or cleaned up once a week in a river somewhere. You know, we now take a shower once a day, so we're more civilized. All of that kind of information, when you start to see the continuity of it, that it's the same thing that we've been talking about, and that at every juncture, you know, whether it was the Egyptians or whether it was Christianity or Judaism or any of them, there's a history that came before, but in order for the people who were in power at that point had to encapsulate it some way to manage people, to control people, to have power, to whatever it is that they were looking for at the time. So they change up the story and they rewrite the story and they make the story sound a little different or more toward their bent, because that's going to give them control and power in a situation. And so it's important to be willing to explore those things, because the depth they bring to understanding the human experience, if that's what you're looking for, is absolutely profound and absolutely mind-blowing when you contemplate that the idea that in a time frame that my brain can't comprehend, 32,000 years ago, somebody was already talking about many of the things we're addressing here, whether living in love, living in fear, how we treat each other, what are our belief systems, what are our truths, who are the gods, are there gods, you know. I caught a quick glimpse of something on there that was specifically saying, or maybe you said it, that you know, Thoth didn't consider himself a god, that was, there was still God, there was the creator beyond whoever this being was. Mm-hmm. So there's still that as above, so below idea, you know,
right.
and all of those interesting things. So I'm not sure where all that goes. I just know that for me, that has been a very interesting overlay in my experience, where the uncivilizedness of us is present in our experience right now. And it looks like it used to look like, or what we say it used to look like in our history. It's just, you know, whether it's we're a little more formal about how we approach whether we're going to take somebody over or take somebody down.
Right.
We're a little more formal about how we play the risk game in the world. But it's still the same game. It's still conquest. It's still managed, you know, who's my ally? Who's my enemy? Who do I, you know, and setting up trade. It's just now we have 7.5 billion people on the planet instead of 5 million people on the planet or 10 million people on the planet. And that's huge, because all of that information has the potential to enlighten us to better ways of living in the present that are not as antiquated or barbaric or not serving. You know, we're supposed to be evolving. And evolution has to happen from within. It can't be a put on a suit of armor or put on a new suit, put on a, you know, a new Burberry suit or put on a new polo suit. You know, whether it goes from armor suits to suits you wear in the office, it's still all the same thing, you know. I have no idea if that made any sense, but it did to me.
Well, you bringing up the idea of evolution takes me back to the video with Bruce Lipton and Tom Campbell.
Yeah.
When they were, you know, these guys are a couple decades older than you and I, and maybe read one or two more books, done a couple more experiments in the extra time they've been here. But remember, they reduced everything down to two things they could agree on. One, that energy exists, and two, that evolution takes place. Those were the two things that they could base everything else they talked about on. Those assumptions was that there's energy and that there's evolution. And that was the only thing. Those are the only two things out of these two brilliant men that they could say are safe to make every other assumption from. Mm-hmm. So somehow we got back there again, but in your world and in my world, I can certainly say you'd have to be a fool to say energy isn't something that you could say is an absolute, mm-hmm. a truth, if you will, since we're playing around with the topic of truth.
Yeah.
And that over time, perhaps things can not only evolve, but they devolve only to evolve again. The way that I would support that statement would be a mentor that I hope to one day meet face to face that I only know through reading his books, Greg Braden, talks about some of his world travels. He likes to take groups of people to places where, like Machu Picchu is one of the places that he takes people that did some amazing things, and they left some artifacts behind that make us scratch our head and say, how did they do that? How did that work back then? One of the places that he goes, there are historical artifacts that support that nuclear energy has been here on the planet before our time in human history, and that in South America that there are, when I say artifacts, when a nuclear reactor goes wrong, it melts elements that can only look a certain way because of nuclear fission or fusion. So sand looks a certain way and carbon looks a certain way, and different elements, when they've been exposed to nuclear energy, a meltdown, if you will, like a war took place, like nuclear missiles or bombs or rockets or some kind of exchange took place, or they just had nuclear energy here on the planet, and due to a cataclysmic event like a volcano or a earthquake or something ruined it, and the byproduct was these melted minerals and elements that support the idea that nuclear energy has in fact been here on the planet before. We're not the first. We think that we're the first ones. Mm-hmm. We think that the book started 6,000 years ago, and wow, how amazing are we that we have nuclear energy now, and we can fly. And it's like we're just now beginning to catch up to civilizations who've been here before who make us look like freaking idiots.
Yeah.
But our ego says we're the most advanced civilization that's ever been here before. And I'm at a place where I'm like, go ahead.
It's so interesting to me that we primatize those races of people in a way. When we teach, when they're taught in history, there's a lot of making them less than we are.
That right.
They were primitive. They were, you know, even with all of the gold and crazy wonderful clothing and hats that the Egyptians supposedly wore, they were still primitive in comparison to what we are. And yet I think they were on the planet longer than we've been on the planet, I think. I don't know if that's, well, yeah, because they, well, I don't know. Wasn't the, I thought the Egyptians were around for 5 or 6,000 years, weren't they?
Yeah. They've certainly been here longer than 1776 to 2018.
Or even BC to AD. You know?
Right. Yeah.
Right. Still longer.
So let's get back to the, if this energy being entity, godlike energy called Thoth, left these emerald tablets behind for us to get some guidance from, some understanding from, and in their translation, literally, I mean, you're going to have to go check this out for yourself, gang. I suppose I could have written some of this down and recited it, but if you're willing to just take a summary from Doug on it, it was translated in the King James for a reason. And it reads just like you're reading Proverbs or just like you're reading some of the Old Testament, to where it's describing stories and it's describing encounters and events like, oh my gosh, this was written down 38,000 years ago. And then it's being retold within the last 6,000 years. So really, which one was it?
I'll share a paragraph.
Okay.
This is from the Key to Above and Below, which is considered Tablet 11. I'm just picking a random thing here. Now shall I speak to thee knowledge ancient, beyond the thought of thy race. Know ye that we of the great race had and have knowledge that is more than man's. Wisdom we gained from the starborn races, wisdom and knowledge far beyond man. Down to us had descended the masters of wisdom, as far beyond us as I am from thee. List ye now while I give ye wisdom, use it, and free thou shalt be. Know ye that in the pyramid I builded are the keys that shall show ye the way into life. I draw ye a line from the great image I builded to the apex of the pyramid, built as a gateway. Draw ye another opposite in the same angle and direction. Dig ye and find that which I have hidden. There shall you find the underground entrance to the secrets hidden before you were men. I could go on if you'd like, but that was two stanzas.
Right. So do you find it interesting that in all of the ways that that could have been translated, that it came out in a King James-ish way?
Yeah, seriously.
And particularly as you get into, you do a whole book of this stuff, and it's just like, because I was well-versed and studied and disciplined in the holy book that we call the Bible, it was so apparent to me that, my goodness, this is not an original work. And I wasn't really, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I probably would have been put off by or even upset that it would feel like a fraud or a deception.
Mm.
And as a result of going through discussions I've had with Timothy and certainly a lot of our work in this podcast, I'm not disappointed any longer. It's just kind of how it is. It's just kind of how it shows up that for some reason we've been taught and we accepted, most people were taught and most people accepted that the reset button happened only 6,000 years ago and everything has come forward since that time. Although that doesn't line up with our science at all. For people that do practice some form of spirituality or religion, it's hard to get away from that.
So I feel a little bit like we're dancing and we're not diving.
Okay.
So you've kind of talked a little bit about why this is significant to you. You know, the connection that you see and feel and read as you read it, that it has this sort of idea that it was the word before the word was the word.
I like that.
So what's that significance to you? Why does that matter? What is it about that brought that to the table today? What's happening in your heart that you're like, there's something I got to say here.
Yeah. So without trying to intentionally offend anyone, the Holy Book has this idea that we're here once. So it's a one and done mentality. It's a one and done experience. Mm-hmm. Most everything else that I've read and understand and makes far more sense to me is that we've been here many times and will continue to be here many times. And not only here, that there are other places in the universe that we have a chance to explore and experience as well for the purpose of understanding, period. Just for the purpose of understanding and having and doing that through experience. It's not just book knowledge. It's experiential knowledge. So the Bible doesn't allow for that. The Bible would only allow me to have this one experience of, say, 80, 85, 90 years and base my entire cosmological understanding of the freaking universe on that one experience. And that just doesn't do anything for me any longer. And this idea that there's a daddy in the sky that is going to be upset with me for whatever reason, because I wasn't taught a certain way, or I didn't have parents that believed in this and they led me in that direction and my society believed in that, and that I would potentially have my eternal outcome based on a blip, on not even a blip on the eternal radar screen from one thing, makes zero sense to me. It only creates fear, only creates dissonance as opposed to resonance.
Yes.
So what our discussion up to this point today is about for me is just yet one more source, one more historical document that predates in every way, shape, or form, and has the same information.
Well, and that's the key thing that I think is so important, is that the message, and to your point, particularly about talking about religion and for people that might want to get their panties in a wad, here's the deal. The thing is, and the reason this is significant, is because the message is the same. The core of the message. If you dissect the Christianity model, you're going to find paganism, you're going to find all of the ancient religions are tied to Christianity in some form or another. They just changed words. They changed the names of what things were and made them something else. And that includes the holidays. That includes the great sacred holy days, which they raped from some other culture or from some other experiences, and then demonized those experiences so that we would only believe this particular bit of stuff. Because they took that core that you saw in the Emerald Tablets, that core of the love expression, that core of we are meant to do and be greater things, and then took a whole bunch of restriction and a bunch of fear and laid it over the top so they could manage the people. And that's not me being paranoid. That's not me being, I don't feel in any way paranoid. I don't feel in any way beat up by the religion. I feel that it served its purpose, because it brought me to a place of greater awakening when I realized that I could no longer be satisfied in the human experience thinking that Big Daddy was up there watching me and pissing on my parade. You know, and not only that, he wanted to piss on my parade because I wasn't doing what he wanted me to do. And I'm like, wait, that doesn't make sense, because the core of all, the core of all the Eastern philosophy is unconditional, is unconditional love. And the space of love and creating that. And we kind of moved away from that to this angry, vengeful experience, which, again, serves nothing, because it doesn't create forward motion. It creates stagnance. It creates stagnation. It creates larger illness because we're in a constant battle of fighting ourselves rather than accepting and loving and saying, this is who I am, and I came here to explore. I came here to engage this planet in a way, you know, like you talk about my move here to Denver. You know, I laugh when I talk to people. I say, you know, I spent 25 years in the desert. I spent 10 years at the ocean. Now I want to go live in the mountains. I want to go experience that. Because this is a big frickin' place. You know, this is a big old world with like the most amazing things to see and do. Why do I want to be stuck in a little box or in a little book?
Right. Right. Yeah.
What's the point? Let's move beyond. Our whole desire to have adventures in truth is to say, hey, there's so much more to truth. There's so much more to truth than I am the way, you know, as it's outlined, you know, in Genesis or as it's outlined in the Old Testament, however it's outlined. You know, that there's so much more to this experience and what we can have in this experience without all that limitation, without all the, you know, without all of the fear mongering and all of the not enoughness.
Right.
Why do we want to constantly be beat with the idea that we're not enough? It doesn't make sense. So that we can live small, you know. And then this is not the point where you break out the pom-poms and go, yay, team, let's go, rah, rah, rah. It's about, to me, it's about wake up. Come on. There isn't a human being alive, to my way of thinking. There isn't one human being that hasn't had the thought. Not one. I don't care where you're from. I don't care who you are. You've either been confronted with it or you've had the thought yourself that says, this is limiting. Why do you keep doing it? And I would stake a lot of money to say that I can't imagine there's any human being that hasn't had that thought.
Sure. Yeah,
you know, and by virtue of having the thought is the stimulation. We've been trained to believe that having that thought is actually antithetical to development, is antithetical to our growth and antithetical to the path of love. And it's completely the opposite. It's actually the entrance to the path. It's the place that you start. It's the place that you go, wait a second, there's more to what I'm doing here. What is the more? And then being willing to see it, being willing to feel it, being willing to evolve into it, whatever it looks like, without judgment, one of the things lately that I think is so extraordinary that in my own meditation, in my own process of contemplation, is this idea that because everything is either crouched in love or fear. So if your perspective is love and you recognize the love that exists and the love that was in place that created this world and the place in us and everything that's in it, that you can't, when you bring the limitations in that experience, you have nowhere to go. You're stuck in this little box and this little playpen that doesn't allow you to expand and grow. So why not embrace things like the Emerald Tablets? Who cares if they're real? I don't care if they, I mean, I'd love to see them. I think it'd be cool to see these things and go, wow. But in the end, it's what is this message promoting? What is this message stimulating? If it stimulates fear, you're in the wrong place.
Right.
Right? If it stimulates anything other than awe or at minimum curiosity, you know, but then we use the book to smack ourselves up the head and say, stop being curious. You don't, no. God didn't say be curious.
You know? Well, if nothing else, if we could say that something was written 38,000 years ago that stimulates thinking today, there was intelligence here. There was wisdom here 38,000 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't primitive. You know, it's interesting. I would love to be able to substitute the word simpler for a primitive. Because what if the Atlantean civilization or the Aztecs or the Egyptians or any of the great races that are no longer here, what if the reality was it was simpler? There was a clarity in that, or they were here for a specific purpose. They came and did what they did. They lived, you know, their thread of experience was to learn how to manipulate matter in forms that we don't even understand yet.
Right.
You know, or whatever it was that they were all here to do. I mean, but those cultures, those whatever, all had enormous impacts. You know,
it was this idea that another, and I'm totally not tied to this idea of whether truth is real or not. It's just like, hey, it came to me, and I'm willing to be the guy who doesn't have to be right, and is just kind of like, what if it? And let's play with that. Let's let that be devil's advocate for a month or two or three, and kind of see what shows up there. And something's going to show up, and we'll either dismiss it by Christmas, or we'll still be talking about it by Christmas.
Well, it seems more and more, you know, interesting that you're bringing that up again, because it does seem more and more, at least in feeling to me, that there seems to be a bit more truth to the idea that truth is about individual experience and perception. And as opposed to what would be considered laws of the universe, so to speak, which are just those immutable things that, but even those, it's kind of hard to say, are they or aren't they? And in the end, what difference does it make? Meaning, I can't follow somebody else's truth. I can only be in my truth.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to be in someone else's truth, it's not a very happy experience. Because then there's no real connection or alignment to your own energy system. You're kind of pissing it all away on somebody else's something. And so there's not really any, you're not connecting to self in the same fashion. So it's more and more, getting more and more fascinating sort of thinking about how truth shows up and how much of it is really tied to intention. You know, that the truth, the thing that I would call a truth is really, I guess tied to bone. Even as I'm sitting here thinking about it, I'm thinking, there are consistent experiences that I have had, and this move is one of them. This impending move was this clarity and intention about creating a shift in my experience, and about, you know, feeling like there wasn't energy here for me in not being able to get traction, and thinking, okay, maybe I'm not in the right place. Maybe I need to change things up. And that being my truth. But what I realize about it for me is that truth is consistently and unerringly doesn't alter regardless of circumstance. So when I came to my truth about the need to move, I was absolutely clear that regardless of circumstance, that would have to be, that's what would take place. And it's a feeling thing. It's like, it's a clarity that you have where if Michael chose not to go, it doesn't change my need to go. And so that would create a whole other dynamic that would have to be assessed. And what would have to be sacrificed for that? Because something would have to give. Someone, either someone gives up some of who they are, or in staying in who you are, you move forward without the other person. Not out of anything other than, it could still be in complete love, but the clarity, the truth of what I know I need doesn't change, even if the person closest to me can't handle it. Mm-hmm. Even if my mind has 47,000 reasons why, mm-hmm. it shouldn't, couldn't, wouldn't, can't, won't, we're all going to die,
uh-huh.
It doesn't change what I'm doing.
It
doesn't alter anything, except...
I'm stumbling over semantics right now, perhaps.
Let's clarify.
I'm hearing you talk about flow, but using the word truth to talk about flow.
Mm.
And are those synonymous for you, or can we separate them a little bit?
So, when I have a clarity of intention, and that intention is my truth, all that can come from that is flow. If I stay in that space, if I attempt to decide how it's going to happen, I put resistance in the process, and now it's no longer flow. If I push in any way, if I get impatient, I'm putting resistance in the process, and that slows things down. I think you can derail yourself, but flow to me is the result of being aligned with your intention and your truth, which usually are pretty synonymous. But flow is more a result of those energies. They're not interchangeable. I mean, you can't call truth flow. They also, I think, are
when you say
different words
my
in
truth,
English.
That to me, you're describing my path, what I'm supposed to do, the direction I'm going in, the rate at which I'm going in it, or pausing. So, and to me, it's flow would be the opposite of resistance, and it's happening. I mean, somebody could climb Mount Everest, and they're not just going to flow right up there.
There is
significant. Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert at that. But
flow would mean being able to move through that experience without unnecessary resistance, mm-hmm. without unnecessary obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that because I'm in the zone with what I know to be true for myself, that the movement. The movement up the mountain is, there are certain paths that are prescribed for going up the mountain.
Sure.
Right.
Based on weather, time of year,
right.
amount of snowfall.
So that's already a done deal. So you're choosing whichever of those paths you feel best suits this apparatus,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, and that's going to include how much weight you're carrying.
Sure.
It's going to include...
Last time you tried it. The Sherpa that went up 2 weeks before.
Exactly.
And made it.
Yeah. So there is a... In that case, the flow is in... I am in alignment with my environment. I'm in alignment with my destination. I'm in alignment with all of this. My focus is I want to get there. So I've got the best Sherpa. I've got the best team. I've got the best equipment. For me, whatever that may look like,
mm-hmm.
and that's all been coordinated because I've picked the right people to be in the right circumstances of this experience, or they've picked me, depending on how they showed up in my life. Because my intention was I'm getting to the top of the mountain, so all the cooperative components or all the details that come together as a result of that, the ease and flow is how much do I believe I can get there? How much trust do I have in me to know that I can make the journey from here to there? And while I can read all the books about all the people's experiences and all the people who died in avalanches and all the people who fell off the mountain and all the people who, you know, all those things that happened, and I can incorporate that into my thought process, into my consciousness, that will then become part of my journey because I have now entrained my system to things that are not necessarily ease and flow, and they were somebody else's experience. But now I've put those kind of chunks in my system. Doesn't mean you have to create it, but if you put enough energy there, then that's what your flow is going to be. If your flow is, I got the best team. I know the route that serves me and this team. I know blah, 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 blah. And trusting that process, then you create a whole different flow, and that flow becomes one that's synonymous with your vibration. And it doesn't mean that stuff can't happen. It doesn't mean that you're not going to get blasted into the side of a mountain by a snowstorm.
Right.
But what it means is that your alignment, your clarity, and your unwillingness to put resistance into the process, that you experience that as a part of the journey of the process and not a hindrance to the process. It's all focused on how the focus is different. If you think about that in terms of, well, I want to go to the top of the mountain, but I don't want to feel wind and I don't want it to rain. Well, you could go there and you could potentially create enough intention and have enough clarity that your energy could be big enough to create a bubble that could create that to happen. But the likelihood is there's a whole lot more influences going on than just me on the mountain. So willingness to recognize that whatever shows up is part of the journey. And you say, cool, okay, so how do I... And that's the difference that we talked about before, about approaching in fear versus approaching an opportunity. In fear, it's all resistance. It's all, oh my God, it's raining, oh my God, we're going to die, oh my God, this is over. In opportunity, you go, oh, I get to experience this weather phenomena. I've been trained for it, I know what I need to do, I know what we need to set up, I know the people who are with me know what we need to do, so let's hunker down, because all we get to do for the next 12 hours is hunker down. But I brought my Uno game so that we can at least enjoy each other while we're hunkering down, you know, whatever the case may be. So you have more, it's opportunity, it's not fear.
Let's keep climbing Mount Everest.
Okay.
It would be fascinating for me to know the data between the number of people who have set the intention and who came prepared with training and expertise and resources and time to accomplish that feat. And some people, it worked out in their very first expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought everybody to the top and they got everybody back down. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just making it up, that it's a possibility. And there are people that in their 10th expedition have never been to the top. And every time they tried, someone died, or life and limb in some way were risked. But their intention was the same as the person who had complete flow and all of life's mysteries unlocked, all the doors and the weather and the climate and the chirpas and the crickets, everything aligned for them to have that experience. What I've learned as a psychotherapist is the person that's still working at it in their 10th time is actually the one that's far more committed to it and has far more life lessons to learn from this experience, and it means more to them than the person who just nailed it the first time around. And that, I mean, there's value to each, but it's actually, you know, was it Einstein who talked about the journey being more important than the destination, the experience along the way? So it's kind of hard to say. It's certainly not being a mountain climber.
The person who's gone for the 10th time and still hasn't done it can still be in flow.
Mm-hmm.
They can still be completely in flow. But like you said, there is more to their journey, more to the unfolding of it, and they're more willing to explore it. But there's also the flip side, which is what's the difference in the core vibration of each individual? Because while they have an intention, it doesn't obviate all the energy you bring to the event or to any experience. You know, to the points that you've talked about, at least the way I see it, there's unlimited possibilities for what's going to provide you the greatest forward momentum. You know, for the person who was able to coordinate and get up there and do it in one shot. One, like you said, one way is not right and the other way is wrong. It's what serves that individual. What is the is it that the person who's on their 10th excursion is still working through what it means to be successful? Are they working through what it means to achieve a goal? Maybe they don't have any idea how to achieve a goal. So they don't realize that it's their energy and their focus that achieves the goal. And so I'm saying this is all hypothetical.
Right, sure.
But in the end, you know, the persistence, yeah, you learn a lot. Do you learn more? I don't know. Are you learning the same lesson? You know, is it the 10th time because you still refuse to pay attention to what's the nose on your face? You know what I mean? That expression,
right.
You know, is it the 10th time because you don't have enough patience to flesh out the details that you need to know? And that's the continuing theme of your journeys is your unwillingness to focus on, you're willing to focus on the goal, but you're not willing to focus on the detail. The things that help to smooth out that flow and that journey. Because you are the only one who can influence that. The people that are there with you are influenced by you because it's your intention. And yeah, there's 10 or 12 people in your group, and maybe they all have different intentions or different ideas, but if you coordinated it, then your energy is what prevails in the entirety of the group, and everybody else is contributing according to that energy, from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many possible variations for good and bad, you know, positively and negatively, for why that 10 trips are successful or not successful. Has that person come to a point where they realize that success is not about necessarily getting to the top of the mountain?
Right. Right.
Because for some, that's huge. For others, it doesn't matter.
One of the things I've always found fascinating about people's experiences of achieving a goal like that is the amount of time and effort it takes to get to the top. And they talk about the 10 to 15 minutes of being at the top and how quickly it's over and how fast that experience vanishes, perhaps only to have a catastrophe on the way down, and that it's really hard to remember and hold that with you. People are devastated afterwards because it wasn't what they thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And particularly if it was their 10th time and they finally made it, and then they recall all the people that died along the way with them, that it was like, you know, you could, the whole evaluation after the fact is really fascinating as well. I know.
I love that you said that, because that speaks to exactly what we were just talking about. It's there's so much fertile ground to dig into just in those five or six sentences you just said about what drives people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all about energy. It still comes down to the core vibration.
Yeah. I have a sense at some level what drives us is this desire to feel alive. And that's maybe a truth we could agree on, that there isn't any other reason to come here. If you're not going to get on the court and play the game, there's really no point in doing it.
That was my job title when my ex and I, the center that I worked in, I was the director of aliveness therapy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
My job,
I love it.
Swear to God. And my job was taking these deathly ill people to the Grand Canyon and running them all over the Grand Canyon, literally running them all over the Grand Canyon, and having them remember what a lie felt like, what a lie feels like, and getting back in touch with that experience in themselves to help them to reverse their disease processes.
Yeah. You know, if we could camp on that for a moment, since we both resonated with that notion of this, perhaps a core truth of why we come to the planet. It's of most interest to me, to the degree people go out of their way to avoid discomfort. So if you separate things into the category of comfort versus discomfort, mm-hmm. the vast majority of humanity will choose comfort. Mm-hmm. To the degree that the senses are dulled so much, there's no sense of aliveness in that place. It blows my freaking mind. Yeah. I mean, this is like a core theme that I'm dealing with on a daily basis of the creature comforts that we cannot help ourselves from padded chairs and air-conditioned environments and filtered this and just thread counts on sheets, and it's just, oh my gosh, you know, oils and lipsticks and things. It's like, how did we get there to avoid the sensation of aliveness? Just bizarre to me. And it's like, the more that you go to the quietest car, the softest ride, the somebody opening your door to, like, you don't have to do anything, and then you're going to go eat the most succulent meals. So it's almost like there's this extreme kind of, you're going to stimulate the senses in one way beyond measure, like to even go into a room where people are wearing a blindfold and it's all dark to heighten the senses of smell and taste, and you're eating lion. Or you're
eating...
Have you done that? No, I haven't. No. I haven't.
I've seen those too. I haven't done it.
It was a thing for a while, yeah. And it kind of came and went.
Yeah.
But it's just of interest to me that there's this... To be considered, say, in high society or the upper crust, that in one regard you avoid discomfort by seeking lavish comfort, but at the same time, maybe to counter that, you're looking for all these exotic experiences to try to balance it all out. And you wouldn't have to do that if you simply stepped into a little bit of discomfort. Like, go sweat. Go sit in the sun for a while. Sit on a log. When's the last time anybody has sat on a log or a rock as opposed to a comfy chair or a chaise lounge with stitch counts in the thousands? And some cabana boy to come rub suntan lotion on you. And as much as it sounds like I'm judging and pointing fingers, I know there's 10 pointing right back at me when I'm doing the same thing in just a little bit different way.
Well, there's a difference between, I think, indulging and experiencing. I mean, I think we're here to experience. So experiencing thousand count thread sheets would be a cool thing. Do I need to live in them? Probably not. If I did experience them, would I want to live in them? I don't know, because I haven't experienced them. Well, maybe I have, but if I have, I don't know. Those things to me are like interesting, inconsequential kind of things. I mean, it's always cool to experience, you know, things that are not normal to my normal experience. It's always cool to have that kind of, you know. I remember we went to the Biltmore in North Carolina. It's the Hearst Estate, I think. Is it Hearst? I can't remember. Biltmore. No, it's Biltmore. Hello. It's this huge castle in North Carolina. And it's on this gorgeous acreage, and they've turned it into a museum. But it was this guy's house, mm-hmm. and he built it for his wife, and it's just kind of interesting when you go through it, thinking how people lived here. What an odd experience that must have been. Because as you're walking through this place, it's like, it isn't very user friendly. You know, it doesn't have a whole lot of warmth to it.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's these, just these unbelievable spaces, opulently appointed and, you know, beautifully done. But then you try to put yourself in the position of living in that and going, wow, this is weird. I mean, I don't even know what this is. I can't find a level of comfort in it personally, you know. But there are other types of wealth that definitely appeal to me, that I would think, oh, no, I could do that. You know, like Richard Branson's type of money.
Yeah.
The way he uses his money, to me, is a little different than the way some others use their money. The thing is, to me, is that's remarkable is there's really no wrong truth in the sense that everybody's doing what they think they should be doing. Whether they're, even if they're in resistance or they're in some situation that they would prefer not to be, or something that's beyond what they would have expected, I think there's just that sense that everybody's doing what they need to be doing. And it seems more and more that in relationship it makes it a little different because we really have to take into consideration that you're involved with someone whose truths may be vastly different than yours.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily affect compatibility, but it definitely affects how you perceive things. Because my truth, like even with this move, my truth about the move, I'm still discovering impact that this is having on Michael that just never even occurred to me. He's moving out of San Diego where he's lived his whole life pretty much. His a large portion of his family is here, and he's never lived anywhere as an adult, never lived anywhere else.
That's huge.
And he's just like, he's going through his paces, but his truth is, I love my husband and I support him. And this is important, so this is what we need to do.
And it'll be okay.
out of his mouth. And it'll be okay. And it's going to be good. And I'm going, and at every level, even as I think about it, it makes me emotional because it's just extraordinary for somebody like me, who I think I'm pretty conscious, I'm pretty aware, and how much I have no frickin' idea, even in my own awareness, how much I don't know. And it shows up every day, and you go, holy crap, I didn't realize I didn't know that either. But gosh, it's just amazing, and it just brings a depth and a richness to the experience, when I think about that. And he's never once pushed back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's just kind of dealt with his own experience and his own process, and it's come out in weird ways, in some ways that, we might brawl a little bit. But ultimately, none of it is out of lack of support. It's just him finding his way into his support, and he needs to figure out how to get there from here. And because I've made a decision that radically alters his path, he's got a few more boulders to navigate around than I would have considered, because for me it was just a point of clarity, right? I have family here, I have friends here, but my clarity is in moving, so I'm good with it, and I'm good with that change, and so it's very emotional, but it's not hyper emotional. It's like I have throughout the day, I'll have 2, 3, 4 times a day where something will show up somewhere and I'll start tearing up, and there's no story, there's no nothing, just this emotion, this feeling of this tremendous change that's happening.
Right. Well, you're feeling.
Oof.
You've just kind of got us back to where we started down this little tributary, which is we're here to feel.
Mm.
And those feelings have a wide range of euphoria to horror. And one isn't any better than the other. Mm. And oftentimes, the things that are most challenging and most difficult, we remember the most, and that has the most value to us. And most war vet type reunions, the guys aren't going to talk about,
hey, remember the time that all the beer showed up and we got Playboy magazines delivered and we all sat around and did nothing for 6 hours and drank beer and looked at magazines? No, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about, remember when Bob's head got blown off and, you know, you were holding it and, you know, and all the gunfire and the grenades? And I mean, they're talking about the most intense experiences that they had. And it built a sense of camaraderie of out of that aliveness that they both got to share, that they all got to share, is what brings them back together again, that they're trying to hang on to or relive mm-hmm. or experience once again. So this move is, you know, a high point in each of your lives that is forcing you to feel. Mm-hmm. You're out of your routine and habit, which we don't feel when we're operating in routine and habit.
Right.
We're not feeling. We're just going along, just the ride. So I know when people, let's say a new restaurant opens and you're driving the same car, maybe wearing different clothes, but kind of going the same time of day, maybe even the same night of week, but it's a new restaurant. Somehow that new ambiance, the new wait staff, the new menu or whatever is shifting enough of the repetition that this is the new thing. We have to come here now, but then pretty soon that habituates and it's just like all the others. Mm-hmm. It's a Friday night, put on some nice clothes, drive to, you know, and it's just like now though that blends in with all the other 200 times I've done that. And it's kind of like, I don't even remember them because mm-hmm. I really wasn't that alive. Or did that steak taste that much different than the 100 others that I've had? Or did they, you know, sometimes maybe there'll be a presentation or there'll be something that will occur that will make you feel alive to the point where there's a little two or three brain cells that will connect to that and go, oh, I have a memory of that one. We got in a fight there at that one. Or we got a flat tire on the way. Or we stopped and had sex on the way or something. I don't know. But that sense of, we've stumbled onto the truth of we're here to feel alive. And it isn't always at Disneyland that we feel alive. It isn't always in the bedroom doing the wild thing that we feel alive. Those are examples of that.
Yeah, but feel alive at Disneyland. Just feel overwhelmed and annoyed.
Which is a way of feeling alive, but it's like, why am I paying for this, right? Another that's annoyance,
funny. Right?
If we're going to go out of our way to feel alive. Occasionally, I find it interesting that I could be accused of planning activities that require, they're more like marathons than sprints. And I know that by putting it together that way, it's going to create some level of either exhaustion or the sense of being spent. Like, I had to put everything into this. That's going to create a sense of aliveness, and there will be memories, and it just forces it to be memorable in its level of difficulty. And some people question, how can that be fun when it seems like it's so hard or so much went into it? And it's like, man, if it's easy, you're not going to remember it.
Mm.
That's my truth. That's my personal mantra or way of doing that I could go to the swimming pool, my flip-flops and shorts, if I just want to do something easy, and that'll just be one of 1,000 times I've done that it all blends into, it's a non-event because it's not remembered. There was no sense of aliveness there. Not that so, every event has to be at that level.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting, something we talked about early on, is that it speaks to the idea of intention and clarity to a large degree. Because if you're being in the moment and you're letting your intention inform and inspire your choices and decisions, then the things that you do, even if it's just throw on a pair of shorts and walk out and get into the pool, has a different experience because it's not just an activity. It was inspired because I feel like I need to shift something. I need some water. Mm-hmm. I need to be in water. I need to, I want to go move my body. Whatever the case is. And while it may not be this big, you know, memorable event, it isn't a wasted event.
Right.
It's still part of what gets you from point A to point B.
There's something else you said.
Well, none of the breakfasts I've ever eaten were wasted events. They're just not very memorable.
Yeah. But isn't that true of pretty much everything? As you were talking, I was thinking about my trip to Peru, which was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing, unbelievable adventure. I can barely recall most of it. I mean, I can go through chronologically, and I know what we did on this day and this day and this day, and but the experience has already been had. I was there doing it. It's done. So I can share the story of it, and in the sharing the story of it, it'll stimulate some aliveness because it was such a powerful experience. Mm-hmm. But it's not readily present in my experience now. I mean, that was almost a year and a half ago. And I can reflect on how cool it was, but even that requires energy. Mm-hmm. That requires focus going backwards, because I've already been there. I've already done that. So in my consciousness, in my mind, it holds a place of wonder and wonderfulness, but it's not present wonderfulness. It's past wonderfulness.
Yeah.
So in order to bring it here, I'd have to dredge it up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty fascinating, because that speaks to that kind of impermanence, the whole idea that once you achieve it, it's done.
Right.
Moving on.
This whole thing brings me back to that Anthony Hopkins idea that we were talking about earlier. Is like, I've had a lot of dreams in my life. And so have you, both awake dreams and nighttime, nocturnal dreams. And we can't remember them. Most dreams vanish within moments of being awakened. Even the ones that's like, oh, that was such an amazing dream. I'm surely going to remember this and write it down. And 5 minutes later, it's like, what?
Not, yeah.
So what if our awake times are really not that much different? It's just smoke and mirrors, and it vanishes very quickly and gets us ready for tomorrow.
Yeah. But I think it drives home the message of now. Now, 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 you know? Because, you know, if I think about, I know I took as much as I could in every moment when I was in Peru, which is why it leaves... When I think about that experience, the only experience I have is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Right?
There is nothing else to that. I mean, we spent 24 hours going one way and 26 hours coming the other way. I slept on the floor in Mexico City in the airport for 7 hours. You know, I mean, there were some pretty shitty things that happened. I mean, inconvenient. Let's say
there were challenges.
But that's not what I remember. I mean, I do now because I was dredging it up. But whenever the idea of talking about Peru comes up, the first word is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Category, you know. And
part of what, in my opinion, part of what made it amazing was the 26 and the 24 and the 7 hour. That's what made, because there was value. That there was a cost. Mm-hmm. That took resources of energy and time and money. Mm-hmm. So it climbed the ladder of value. What you went through to have that experience makes it a value. Because if you just were, if Scotty could teleport you there, you know, on the Enterprise, mm-hmm. beam me up, Scotty, and you were right there and right back again, would not have nearly the same memorable experience. Doesn't mean it wouldn't have any.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't quite be the same. So level of effort to go And again, people that can travel every week, it all starts blending together, and they have unlimited resources, and there's no expense and no time considerations. They don't remember that stuff. It's just one more of many, many experiences.
Yeah, and that's an interesting. I have had for many years this experience about traveling that has always kind of baffled me. Is I don't one city to the next, Who cares?
Well, unless you're doing something different, because if you're going there to eat and you're going there to shop and you're going
like
there to
every
sleep someplace,
other place.
How's that any different than all the other places you've
right.
been?
And that's exactly the experience. It's just like every other place. And you go, so what was all that
I've
about?
I've done this already.
Yeah.
I wasn't at this longitude latitude.
Right. And I didn't have to fly 6 hours to do this. I could do this at home. So
right.
Why did I fly 6 hours to do this? You know, because there is no relative difference except the energy you bring to it. And then it's the energy that you bring to it that's going to make all the difference in what you experience and how present you are in that experience. Yeah, so I don't have, you know, I don't have this big drive to go to particular, you know, like, I want to go see St. Louis. It's another city. Is there something in St. Louis that could be really cool to see? Potentially. Is it something of interest for me? Probably not. But I don't know that for sure because I don't know all the ins and outs of that city. But, and sorry, St. Louis is nothing personal. It was just the first one that came to my brain. So if any of you out there are thinking St. Louis, it's all good.
Hey, at least St. Louis made your brain.
That's right. I don't even know why. But in another way, I find that also completely fascinating. That you could go to so many different cities and basically have the same experience.
Well, yeah.
And that's kind of fascinating. Because you think, I'm in this new place with all these new people and this new stuff and this new thing and it should be different. And
but what's new? What's new? You're eating, you're sleeping, you're pooping,
you're
shopping, there's little trinkets and souvenirs that you think you have to have that 5 years later you won't even remember buying. There's bartering and negotiating and thinking like you got a good deal and trying to figure out the currency of how much Monopoly money is it going to take to get this?
I was down at Cardiff. Actually, Moshe and I were out walking on the beach. And I remember, so I was watching because it was very busy because it's summer here. So, you know, the beaches are busy because it's San Diego. And I just remember looking around at all these people. And, you know, there's families and there's groups and there's couples and there's, you know, big families and small families. And all of these people that came to this place to do their thing called vacation. And I couldn't find one that looked like they had any joy going on.
Oh, really? That's sad.
You know what I mean? Like that really, like, I mean, they were smiling and they were doing their thing, but it didn't, there was no feeling of like, look at this amazing place that I'm at. You know, they're like, I came to California to have a vacation. I'm on the beach and I'm having a vacation.
Sounds like a check in the box.
Yeah. I got my beers. I got my, you know, except you can't have beer on the beach here, but, yeah. And it was just, it's kind of fascinating because it's almost like I'm here because I was told it was a good place to come for my vacation. I've heard that San Diego is amazing, so I should come to San Diego because it's amazing. But circling back around to the idea of intention, you got to make sure you're making all the choices you make from intentionality. So even if going to Omaha, Nebraska seems to spark your interest, then you should go to Omaha, Nebraska. Not San Diego, California. Because if Omaha, Nebraska is what's ringing your bells, then there's something in Omaha, Nebraska that's going to make you go, holy crap, that was amazing. And you could still have a good time in San Diego, but you're not going to necessarily have your holy crap because your inside was saying, Omaha, Omaha, Omaha. For whatever reason. But that's part of that whole trusting the process. That's part of the beingness that we started this conversation with is enabled to, in order to be at the highest levels of aliveness, you have to be at the highest levels of presentness.
Mm-hmm.
In your own experience, in your now, in your energy, in your field, in your body, whatever, however you describe that.
Right.
Because that's where your, that beingness is going to lead you to prompting that's going to take you to the next place that's going to unfold back to the lift analogy. the bell will go off, and the bell will give you a clear direction of where to go. The question is, do you trust yourself and your universe enough to follow it? And say, cool, I don't know, I'm not sure why I'm going there, but it feels really good, and I'm really excited about it. You know, and that to me is, that's living, that's aliveness, that's, you know, that's my version, that's my truth of it. And there are variations of that, you know. But I think that we all have that. I don't think we'd. In fact, I would go out on a limb and say, I know we all have that guidance system. We all have that connection. We all have that ability. It's just a question of whether we use it or not. Whether we tap in. Whether we want to go on that magical mystery tour, or whether we just want to ride somebody else's wave. I haven't found anywhere that riding somebody else's wave is all that fun. Unless they ride big-ass waves, and I'm afraid of big-ass waves, so they're helping me ride the big-ass wave because I've never done it before. Then it's cool.
Yeah.
You know? Then I love it. And we seem to have come full circle again.
Yeah.
We did that really well. Come back to our starting point. I like that.
Yeah, I've got a lot of things kind of trickling through the mind right now with regard to aliveness, being in the moment, the now, having fun, breathing, noticing, being aware, the idea of no mistakes.
What does that mean?
There are no mistakes.
Oh.
It's all part of the journey. This idea that I should have known better. Well, how could you have, with what you had to work with in that moment, at that time, with the amount of sleep, blood sugar level, blah, blah, blah. It's just wishful thinking. But a lot of people I work with are judging themselves, thinking they should have turned left instead of right. And if they would have, they would have, you know, avoided this or benefiting from that. And you know, it's just a little mental masturbation game that we love to play. I don't know where we learned it, but we're all pretty good at it until one day we don't want to be any longer. When I was watching the video you sent a couple of weeks ago, the Dr. Joe video of why we're not happy, there was a little clip in there where somebody put stickers over all of the times on a clock that said now.
Yeah.
So the one. So I did that in my office. I have a big clock like that, and I took a little yellow sticky and just put now and put it over each one of the numbers.
Oh, right on.
And then I took a little bigger yellow sticky and put in the very center of it that there is only now. I'm just, you know, it's been up for a week. And it's been interesting. I see people look over at it, and then they look away like they're pretending that they didn't see it because they don't know what to do with that. And I had one person that actually said, how do you even know what time it is? It's like, well, dude, there's like six other clocks in here. You know, that's just one. But do you want to talk about that? Would you like to get into that? And I had one person that I've worked with for a long time says, oh, you're a Buddhist now. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Is that the definition of Buddhism? You know? But it's been fun to just be with everything is in the now. And if you're not here in the now, you're tripping somewhere else and you're missing out on what's here in this now.
Now.
Yeah.
Because it isn't anywhere else. And it's so funny to me that at this stage in my life to really recognize that there is nothing anywhere else except now. And you go, or I go, you know, part of the mind wants to argue, but there's nothing, there's no argument. There's no, it's just dead space. You just go, oh. Well, it's not really dead space, because if the mind's arguing, it's not dead space. that idea of being present and letting every moment inform the next moment and guide to the next moment, but it's a very seamless thing. I think a lot of people probably either get What are the two things you said? Either afraid or...
Love or fear?
Yeah, the things that pull you to the future or to the past. It was in line with some of those truth quizzes.
Mm.
That being in either of those places can never be satisfied. So that you were talking earlier about that sort of dead zone where people go into no aliveness, chances are good they're being everywhere but in the present.
Yeah.
Because there's
yeah.
a ton of it in the now.
Before we started our podcast tonight, Jim and I reviewed a little bit of a clip from Wayne Dyer's work where he was postulating that perhaps only 3 to 4% of our mind is conscious. A very simplistic way of defining what that means is being aware of in this moment, being present, being awake, not operating off of an autopilot mindset of past memories or just mind muscle memory or that sort of schedule, if you will, but truly being open to the infinite in this moment. And if I respect Wayne, he was on the planet in this incarnation, you know, longer than I, and read a few more books and had a few more experiences, and I'd like to think that that's probably a pretty sound notion, that he's not just grasping at straws and pulling up numbers, but that's astounding. I mean, that's nothing less than, oh my gosh, really? 3 to 4%? And I used to think 12% was an astounding number. And to think that it's even smaller than that, there's a cry. I mean, there's almost like this part of me that's just wanting to yell and scream, wake the F up, be here, get out of the grind, get out of this habitual place that we've created for ourselves to not feel. I mean, really the zombie, I mean, gosh, zombies are so popular, zombies on every channel and every game and all that sort of thing. It's like, well, yeah, I get it now, because that's largely what we have become. You
got to
go to school. you got to get some training after school. You got to find a person. You got to get married. You got to have a car. You got to get a 401k, have a house. And really, I don't know that any of that is of any value. As people achieve it, it doesn't seem to be satisfying to the point where they just sit in their house and go, I'm so glad I have a house!
Yeah, well, it becomes a burden.
Who does that? Who just, like, come over to my house. I have a house. Just come over. Sit on my couch and let's just be here and resonate and I have a house. Like, does anybody do that? No, we gotta watch this 72-inch monstrosity entertainment thing and have the vibration going and it all has to be something else. Let's get into somebody else's life. Let's project ourselves into somebody else's story, because surely their story's got to be better than mine. I got myself started, Jim. We all have, I mean, don't you want it, when you're having people that benefit from getting to spend time with you, don't you just want them to know you have such an amazing life? You don't need anything else. Breathe. Just be you. Celebrate that you're here. Be part of the family. Stop striving. Stop competing.
I find myself saying that a lot to younger people in my car when they're talking about, because where I live is right by SDSU, and you know, I see a ton and Glendale Community or Grossmont Community College, and so I encounter a ton of college age kids. And some a little older than college age that are maybe doing master's programs or PhDs or something else. But the thing that is always fascinating to me is talking to them and then listening and feeling how they feel about what they're doing. And then asking them how they feel about what they're doing.
How's that working for you?
Wow. It's amazing. Because so many when I talk about passion, you know, and I'll say something to the effect of, you know, don't let the system drive the passion out of you. What are you in it for? You know, are you passionate about this, or are you just doing it because this is what you're supposed to do?
Because mm-hmm.
if you're doing it because that's what it's supposed to do, it's going to be a lovely piece of paper that'll never be of value for the rest of your life.
Right. Well, and I'm going to be paying on it for a long time, right? Or somebody will.
But, and it's always a joy to meet someone who has found their passion in what they're studying. And they're doing it because of their passion. Which speaks to what we've been talking about all along, which is they're present in their experience. And their choices are in the presence of their experience. Because they have aliveness in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not... You know, it's not this, okay, I'll get through this 4 years, and okay, then what? Okay, well, I guess I'll do 2 more years because I'm supposed to, or because, you know, whatever. I mean, typically, I think as you get into the higher levels of education, when you get into PhDs and masters and that kind of stuff, if they're choosing that route, chances are good there's a bit of passion there. But that's not always the case. For many, it's still, they're just continuing on the same ladder because that's what they think they should be doing.
Right. It's a program.
Like, do you like
it? It's a program.
Do you like it?
It's just a program.
What do you plan to do when you're done? What are you passionate about? why are you studying this course?
Yeah. Somebody put this curricula together and decided for me what I needed to know.
Yeah.
For sure.
Great topic.
This, when you're involved in things that create a time warp, people will say things like, wow, where did the time go?
Yeah.
You're doing something that is giving you a sense of feeling alive. That seems to be a truism. When there's a sense of distortion of time, something happened. They got your almost full focus, if not full focus, that brought you out of all the programming, all of the rote memorization, all of the check boxes, and you freaking showed up.
Yep.
Those are the things that we, I guess, call passions or try to recreate. It's disappointing when you can't recreate it, because sometimes things are just one-offs. It's like, you got that one, that's all you get, and you're going to have to do some deviation of that. But we try to, like, put all the ingredients back together again to bake that cake again, like it's going to taste the same as it did the first time.
I had a very interesting, actually interesting, another, Jesus, can't believe this has got pinged again. So I was having a massage yesterday, and I have this great relationship with the guy that does my massage, and he's a really, really awesome therapist and very sensitive, huge energy, and at least when he works on me, I'm very aware and cognizant of his energy in the space and how it's working and what's happening in my energy, and you know, it's just, that's sort of my thing, and so I really get into enjoying that experience. So one of the things that's evolved with us over time is he doesn't have the language or the words quite yet for what he experiences. And yet he's still really intuitive and really good at it. And, you know, I just run my mouth, you know. So he's also someone who just recently celebrated his 1 year, 1 year from having a liver transplant. The guy's in his early 30s. has had a liver disease, you know, for a long time. And so he went through this transplant therapy, and then he was gone for a little, you know, he was out of the loop for a little bit. And then when I started going back, I really wanted, after he had worked on me the first time, I wanted to share with him what my experience was, because it was so impactful to me. So I did, and he really appreciated it, and we dialogued like that. And so this massage yesterday, I'm face down on the table, and I went deep really fast, and his hands were like fire from the second he got in my energy field. I mean, like, as soon as his hands touched, literally they were like 95 degree. I mean, they felt hot, you know, and it stayed that way. And as he kept working, he just drove me deeper and deeper, and I was in this really wonderful deep place, and just, I was really, it felt like I was really aware of, he was clearing out some stuff, and he was opening up some channels, and this was all about, in part, about the move and about the transition that's going on, and it was feeling really, really good. And about halfway through, I was like stoned out of my mind. I mean, just from the work, and I sort of propped myself up, and I said, "Can I get a glass of water?" And he was immediately concerned, you know, like, "Is everything okay?" And I'm like, "Oh no, everything's great. There's just a crap ton of energy going on in here today, and I just need some water." So he said, "Well," so I shared with him what was going on, and he said, "Well, since you brought it up," he said, "it's really interesting, because since the beginning of the massage, I've had this thought going through my head," and he said, "and the thought is, he needs to let go of whatever this last thing he's holding on to about this move." That's interesting. And the first thing that went through my mind is my concept about my business is what I have to surrender in this process, is that I am partly having the viewpoint that I may take the business the way, you know, as is, and then when I get there I can start doing X, Y, and Z. Except it's never felt quite right, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, I got it, but I'm not sure, and so I've never really come to a good place about what's going to happen when I get there, because that's part of the house too. But so I said, well, that's the only thing that comes to mind immediately, and I said, but I'm definitely going to stew on that for a little bit, because if that's what you're picking up, there's some energy in there that needs some assistance, kind of moving on. And he said, can I tell you this little parable story that they've shared with me? I said, sure, I'd love, you know, love it. He said, I think it really applies. So he told me this story about this river, and this river runs up to a desert, and the river's goal was to create a pathway through the desert. And so for years, this river kept trying to expand and kept trying to push its way through the desert, And it would extend itself way too far, and all the resources would burn off by the sun, and nothing would happen. And so for years, this went on. And one day, something to the effect of the river, he stopped fighting. The river stopped fighting, trying to push its way across the desert. And so it just was allowing this process of kind of the water trying to move through. And what was still happening was, as the water was moving across the desert, the sun would evaporate the water because it's a desert. But what the river wasn't paying attention to is that the water was evaporating and turning into clouds, and the clouds were going to the other end of the desert and dropping the water. So the river was actually connecting on the other end of the desert. I thought I was going to pee myself after he told that, because that was so, it was so apropos of everything that I'm experiencing. To me, it was this moving from one thing to another, and you're not seeing what the connective tissue is. Don't worry about it. And so that just remarkable kind of thing of this feedback of, okay, just let go. Don't take the concept. Don't even to the degree that I'm paying attention, I'm still trying to drag things. There's still part of me that wants to go, okay, well, I need to take this. So I have this business, and I have this book, and I have these things, and so they're all going to be just like that when I get there. And so all I have to do is just be there, and poof, it's all going to be good. Except my sense is that I don't have a freaking clue how this, what's going to unfold when I'm there, and that what's going to unfold is so far greater and cooler and more interesting than anything I'm trying to dream up from this vantage point.
Right.
You know, it's like, and then I can take a deep breath and go, okay, now I can go back into now. I don't have to spend time worrying about that.
Love it.
You know? And just to get that kind of feedback like that for me is just magical to me. That's just extraordinary. But that parable was just so cool. I mean, he was telling me, it was funny because he was kind of a little timid about wanting to tell it because he wasn't sure if I would. And then he told it, and I just laid there and went, holy shit, that was amazing. I'm going to be thinking about that for days. That's some good stuff. So I feel like we're kind of meandering a little.
Yeah, like the river?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah? Is there a little bit of evaporation taking place?
There is.
Condensation on the other end. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thinking,
well, on the topic of, we opened up this idea of we're here on the planet to feel. And throughout the years I've been doing therapy, I can break that down into people either go way out of their way to intensify certain feelings and to deaden others, mm-hmm. or to eliminate others. And that might be an error or a mistake. If there is a mistake, that could be something we could learn not to do so much of, is that we want to embrace both ends, mm-hmm. of the continuum.
Well, I have a very strong experience. I mean, emotions to me are our guidance system. I mean, at a core level, to me, that they tell me where I am in relation to who I am, what I want, my connection to the larger part of myself, to God, to,
right.
You know.
Well, so many people are entering into the world of the digital, mm-hmm. which is not, it does create feeling, but it's a...
Create sensation. More than feeling, probably.
Yeah, it's not authentic. It's a counterfeit, or it's...
manufactured.
Synthetic,
yeah.
If you will.
Yeah.
So if there is a truth that we could offer... That might be to go back to the analog and to use the body as a primary way of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be through breath, that we would need to breathe deeply and fully and even hard breath of panting, of gasping.
Do you know how challenging that is for people?
For some, yes, I do.
And
they avoid it. Most people's
That's a large part of what I do. It's fascinating.
So, in order to create the ideal brain chemistry, requires 20 minutes of deep breathing and sweating. The combination of deep, full breaths to the point of exhaustion, if not quite to that point, but you know, short of exhaustion, but you're working hard to where the heart's pumping, the lungs are working very at an accelerated rate, and your body is now perspiring in order to cool itself. 20 minutes of that triggers a mechanism in the brain that secretes a variety of chemicals that we simply call brain-derived neurotropic factors. These things include anti-anxiety neurochemicals, enzymes, hormones, neurotransmitters, antidepressants, mm-hmm. Euphoric, all the whole range from the dopamine, the serotonin, oxytocin. Hardly anybody, I mean, the masses are not doing that. It may be more common in Southern California to do that. But most people are not engaging in
that
any
longer.
Well,
that's what's become going to the gym.
But no, not that
doing cardio.
Many people do that.
Right. But actually, the idea of doing cardio is...
5%? You think 5% of America is engaging in 3 times a week, 20 minutes? Not 20 minutes of exercise, 20 minutes of sweating. Because going for a walk doesn't do it. Getting on your exercise bike for 10 minutes doesn't do it. It's only that those... chemicals only start showing up after you've been doing 20 minutes of those combined things that I was talking about. So you may only turn that on for a couple of minutes. If you're exercising for 30 minutes total, you may actually only be generating 5 to 10 minutes of the production of the brain-derived neurotropic factors, which gives us a sense of freaking wellness and health and being alive. And because we're not doing that any longer, we dive more into substances, or we dive more into movies and TV shows and digital video games, and that's where we're headed. And the masses are... Who doesn't have Netflix now? Who doesn't have Amazon Prime? Who isn't listening as to whether or not the new MoviePass app that gives you, like, you know, for $10 a month, you can go to 3 movies for $10 a month to a theater. It's a thing. Wow. It's a thing. Wow. It's a thing.
I'm out of the loop.
But, you know, the movies gives you even more of an experience of I'm in the movie than at home. Anyway, we got to have real experiences. They don't all have to be car crashes either.
Right? Yeah, no, don't think so.
Great topic tonight, Jim.
Yeah.
Great discussion. And you know, they've all been cool. What I like about this one is we just went for it.
Yeah.
There was very little, if any, direction or intentionality at the beginning. It was more of a trust, kind of a, let's just go, see where this takes us. It's good.
I like it.
It's good. Well.
So we talked about what? We talked about intention. We talked about aliveness.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the importance of both of those in staying in the now. And that in the now is where aliveness lives. It's where you find clarity and focus. We talked about a lot of things, but we came back to those themes consistently.
Sure. Yeah, and we could tag that into those seem to be truths. That we're here to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that the best or the most authentic feeling is going to happen with the body. Mm-hmm. As opposed to some drug trip or some digital video game or a movie or a TV show. Nothing against any of those.
Right.
It's just about balance and how much and how often and that sort of thing. But to try to, you know, I'm smelling... What people don't know is we're sitting on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And the boat's moving. There's a light breeze. I smell the smoke from the campfires that's over on the beach. I can actually hear the waves. We heard a bird earlier tonight that sounded like it was murdering something.
Yeah.
The stars are out. The clouds are blowing by. So there's all this analog, real experience happening. And honestly, one of the reasons I like doing this here on the boat is all of that brings me more here and brings more of me here. And whether that's good or not.
Cool.
We'll let the audience be the judge of that. All right. Well, I guess we should say goodnight.
Yeah. Thank you all for joining us in our adventure in truth this week. We definitely appreciate you all out there that are listening and participating with us. And we're looking forward to, in the near future, we're hopefully going to be able to do some live activity and get our audience engaged and involved at some level and being able to... help steer our conversation or inform our conversation or whatever that might look like.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any way for our listeners to give us some feedback? Can they?
They can. Well, they can give us feedback actually via comments on the YouTube.
I'd like to see some.
Yeah, on the YouTube.
Tell
pages.
Us we suck.
Yeah,
we'd get something. That would be awesome.
And you can also do it on the Facebook page because I am... committed now as I produce each video or each segment up to the YouTube page to then share it on our Facebook page. So you can go either place and ask questions, make comments, share your thoughts, add your 25 cents, whatever it is. We welcome that feedback. We welcome the what do you call those? Subscribe to the channel.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Likes and thumbs up and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Sharing and all that's good stuff.
Right on. And thank you for doing that work, Jim. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Thank you for a great night, Jeff.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth Podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. Like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.